This week on the Backtable Podcast.
I have a single page document that I sent out to all my clients. It's what I call a locums profile. It's got my photo, where I trained, and what I consider area of expertise. And then every site that I work at, I solicit reviews from everyone on site. Usually at least once a year. And I have a bar graph that shows, you know, how am I overall? How am I in communication? How am I in friendliness? How am I in actual clinical skill, et cetera, et cetera. And I put that together, and that's what I propose. And it says how many states I've done, how many procedures I've done, et cetera, et cetera. I give that to all my clients to let them know that I know what I'm doing and I've done this for a while.
I think you've given me a good idea what I probably should do.
I'm like, I'm definitely updating my CV.
Selling some of these ideas.
It's great. Like, wow.
Well, I find that it's better than a CV because CV contains a lot of information.
This is very locum specific.
It's very locum specific and it's one page and it hits the high notes. So.
I love it. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Backtable Podcast, your source for all things interventional and endovascular. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and on backtable.com.
First, a brief message from our sponsor.
The HAWK 1 directional atherectomy system treats all plaque morphologies, including severe calcium above and below the knee. If your treatment goal is to make a small channel or to maximize luminal gain, choose HAWK 1 to preserve a patient's native vessel and keep future treatment options open. Risks may include, but are not limited to, arterial perforation or dissection, embolism or arterial thrombosis, and vascular complications that could require surgical repair. Learn more about HAWK 1 as well as risk and safety information at medtronic.com/HAWK1.
For more than a decade, ReFlow Medical has designed and engineered medical devices that respond to unmet clinical needs. The Wingman Crossing Catheter with its unique extendable beveled tip and an expanded indication for CTOs. The Specs LP, created to meet the need for a low-profile version of the Specs Shapeable Support Catheter. And the new line of Core Catheters that answers the call for a suite of effective tools to use in challenging PCI procedures.
Now, back to the episode.
All right, I'm here with my friends here at SIR Live 2023 in Phoenix. With the hot heat and things are about to get a little bit spicy. Backtable coming at you, your source for all things endovascular and interventional. We're here in Phoenix. I'm here with my friends, Kavid Devlapoli and Vishal Kadakia. Great to finally see you guys in person.
Meet in person,
This is amazing.
Yeah. So a little bit about today's episode. We're going to do some updates to a really popular episode last year where we talked about locum tenens in IR. You know, the big bad word, locum tenens. Let's get a little further into it. We all have varying experiences. So how about we just jump right in and just get some updates. Vishal, you want to start? What's been going on in the last year?
Yeah, I think we talked about a year ago. So still doing locums full time. A few new clients, a few old clients. One of my major clients I'm shifting out of. Moving into some new states. I just signed a new client in Alabama. Most likely a new client in Maryland and a few other prospects, but still full-time locums.
And how's licensing been going in all the different states?
I know some people talked about delays due to the pandemic, but I have to be fair. I think I have only had to procure two new licenses in the last year and didn't have any difficulty.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got you. Kavi, what's going on with you?
What's a great way of putting it, Vishal? Same for me. So some new clients, some old clients. I'm still doing a split of half hospital, half OBL. New hospital client. I think last time we spoke, I was in Minnesota. Now have a new hospital client in South Dakota. And then a few OBL clients in Florida, including a new one. So things have been good.
And I'm still a full-time W-2. I have an ample amount of vacation, like a lot of our radiology colleagues do. And I do about 4 to 6 weeks of locums a year. Been with a single group now, and it's been really fantastic. I just want to get right into some of the questions that we've been asked. I know a lot of your DMs have been filling up. You know, not in the way that our celebrity friends' DMs are filling up, but mostly with people who have questions about locum tenens medicine. Like what since this episode went off, I've been getting about one or two questions a week consistently since the episode came out. I know it's been really popular amongst medical students, residents, fellows, and industry, and we just have to acknowledge that openly. And I want to talk a little bit about a conversation that Kavi told me that he had recently with people in the actual locum tenens industry, non-physicians who work in placing physicians into hospital settings. So can you talk a little bit about that, Kavi?
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually all stemmed from Twitter on my blog account, LineMonkeyMD. We had an exchange with a recruiter. Actually, it wasn't even a recruiter. It was a founder of a staffing agency who works specifically with radiology. And it was pretty interesting because he made some comments about, you know, the industry and what he's seeing. And, you know, I actually sent him a message because having lived this life like you, Vishal, I kind of wanted to learn more about it. I think the last time we recorded, I was using a recruiter at that time, kind of like what you were when mm-hmm. you first started. Mm-hmm. And you kind of inspired me to move beyond that. So
I still do for anyone.
It's the way to go. We definitely believe that here. But, you know, there is some value that these guys have, without a doubt. And I wanted to learn a little bit more about how he does things. Because, okay. you know, this is their livelihood and that's what they do. So I actually had a really good conversation with him about his business model. Huh. And I learned a few interesting facts, which I think are actually pretty generalizable to the entire industry, that I'd want to share with our listeners, because I think it's important that we as physicians, we all know this. So
this recruiter staffs exclusively interventional radiology or all radiology seats?
Yeah, great question. All radiology seats.
I see. Okay.
But a pretty good proportion of his business, I think it's up to 50%, is IR.
Okay. Good to know. So he knows the market landscape relatively well at this point.
Definitely. We're talking about 100 different clients coast to coast.
I see. Okay.
So it was pretty remarkable. I think the first question I asked him, and I wasn't expecting him to give me a response, but he did, which I credit him for. I asked him what his profit margins were.
And wow.
Yeah, I know.
Straight off the bat, huh?
Straight off the bat.
Yeah.
Just went straight for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, why not? What do I have to lose? And he was very gracious. And he actually told me between 30 and 40%.
Wow.
Yeah. So I want you know, listeners to think about that. That's a lot.
I found something pretty similar as well. I think that there are gamuts of interventional radiology or staffing companies in general. And there are a few that I think are some of the legacy larger ones that cover multidisciplinary efforts around the country. And I think they have, well, there's probably the jury's out on it, but maybe a more respectable or healthy 20%. But there are a number of other firms that really take some of their clients to the cleaners, I guess would be the right term. And I've seen up to 50%.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And I think we touched on this last time. There's also a component of, even if they know that that's not going to secure the physician, they still have their contract with the client, which then prevents any particular physician with working with that client if they've ever been formally presented. It's a major pitfall that I advise anyone to look into, you know, the idea of presentation to a client.
So if the file has been presented, they hold a non-compete prior to the physician ever being employed there?
That's correct.
So the physician has no contract.
That's correct. I'm not an attorney, so I have to say this with, I have to give that disclaimer, but that's my understanding, is that it's essentially a sandwich agreement. They've got an agreement with the physician if you were to sign, and then an agreement with the client. The client's the first person that they sign the agreement with.
Wow.
So they're double protected in the case where they have a physician and a client both sign. But if they sign with just one, the client, even though you have not signed an agreement with them because maybe you never work there, their agreement with the client still says, we presented this doctor to you, you can't work with them directly.
That is fascinating. What it brings to mind to me is that essentially you're paying someone multiples and on a daily rate a part of your work because they had a head start.
Correct.
Is there another way to think about that or to phrase that? Or are you sort of seeing it a similar way, Kavi?
I see it a similar way. Now you got to think about it from their shoes, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So from their shoes, they're thinking, hey, I'm going out there and I'm establishing relationships.
Okay.
I'm creating opportunities for other physicians to work. And I'm not going to lie. I mean, Vishal, you probably see this in your own life, but this stuff's hard.
It is. Yeah.
It's a lot of business development. Yeah. It's a lot of networking. It's a lot of phone calls. It's getting connected with the right people. So I think one can make an argument from the locums agency side is, hey, we're doing that for you, okay? All you have to do is show up and do a good job,
yep.
right?
Yep.
Now, that's not to say that we as physicians can't do that. We can absolutely do that. But there is a price to be paid for it. Now, whether or not you think 30 to 40% is reasonable, that's up to any given person. But the reason I bring up that number is not to say that locums agencies are terrible,
right?
But it's to really democratize this information,
right.
because mm-hmm. I think all physicians mm-hmm. should know what's at stake.
Absolutely. And if I could just piggyback off that thought process, it took me a while. And of course, I am pretty loud spoken on my opinion on this matter. So take what I say with a grain of salt. But
that's why you're here, man.
The way you describe that, you're talking about it from a physician's perspective, which is, what is the service that they provide? It is my opinion, or at least my limited opinion, that we're not really their client. The client is the entity that needs our services. And so from their perspective, they probably feel very comfortable charging these rates because they're allowing that institution to tap into their vast network of doctors. And by network, that can mean anything from the names and emails and phone numbers, which I'm sure you get a lot of emails and phone calls, as well as knowing which states they're licensed in and who's actively doing locums work. So there's some value, but boy, I really think their target audience is the entity that needs the services, and the physicians are sort of an ancillary thought process. And that's borne out with my experience with how these contracts are structured.
I agree with that. I actually echo that. I mean, I think we see that. I don't know how your interactions with recruiters were, Shaman. You guys both have interactions all the time, but oftentimes it's something to the extent of somebody from South Florida will send you a text message and they'll ask you what your rate is.
Always.
And that's it.
Yeah.
There's no discussion about the job or anything else, or your motivations or your interests or whatever true value you can really add to a practice.
No location.
What's your rate?
Yeah.
Right? Because how are these guys making money? They're making money getting, you know, contracts from hospitals.
Yeah.
Largely. So no question about it.
So where does this go? Right? We're in a transitional period.
Yeah.
The demand is increasing. The physician shortage is increasing. We know that. That's fact. That's published. That's all of medicine, not just interventional radiology. Let's make this podcast translatable to other specialties, right? This episode. Maybe we'll be the most downloaded for 2023. Let's see.
Not maybe, definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, we will.
Right. Yeah. How does this translate into the next 10 years of a physician shortage with locums companies as, I mean, you may say that, you know, they're not you know, a middleman. I forget your exact phrasing, but, you know, to me they are to a degree a middleman. I do not use one. I'll be, you know, very forthright. I only do a few weeks a year. I have a fantastic relationship with the group and now the hospital that I work in. We'll get into that in a little bit. I don't believe in it. I think my rates are very fair.
Yeah.
And the hospital agrees that my rates are very fair. So I found it to be an unnecessary step in the middle outside of people who simply don't have the networking to find contracts. So a big part of this conversation on round two of locums is how to actually find the job and to secure the job. Yeah, that's going to be a big theme here.
Can I add something in the backdrop that might give some perspective? This is just an N of one thing that I've seen recently. One of my clients or potential clients, and I don't know if you've seen this, Kavi, with anyone else, but is now restricted by a exclusive locums contract.
Yes.
And I don't know if you've seen that elsewhere. It was the first time that I saw it.
Yeah,
and,
I've seen it.
That is something that maybe for our audience members who are maybe not on the physician side, but or maybe are physicians, but maybe thinking about locums, to think about the pitfalls of an exclusive contract. I can tell you just anecdotally, they're still struggling to fill these spots, and it really puts everybody in a pickle, and it leaves me without an option to work with this client unless I go through the agency.
Well,
sorry to interject. I just wanted to, as a backdrop of maybe something that's changed in the market. I have not seen that before.
It's a great point, and we can start with that.
Yeah.
Why don't we start with that? So I work for a large group. That's you know, my group is local, but everything is national.
Yeah.
On the business administrative side. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to name names.
Yeah.
And it's been a very pleasant experience for me.
Yeah.
I have a wonderful life, and I enjoy it very much, and I have a lot of freedom. As this group and similar groups like it gain more hospital contracts and now have locums arms, which I'm sure you both have interacted with personally.
Correct. Yeah.
What does that do to the locums market?
Well, Kevin, I'm curious what you think. The client that I'm talking about is not a national entity. Well, they kind of are, but they're looking to source a local need. And this is not I don't know how to describe this. This is not a locums agency in name only. It's an actual locums agency. I think what you're referring to is some of the national entities have their own arms.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is their response to some of these crazy rates or profit margins that some of the agencies can take. I use the word crazy. You know, again, it's all up for debate. I have my own opinion. I've been loud spoken about it. But I think those are two different things.
Okay.
The agencies that are agencies in name only, but really are tied at the hip with the actual national entity. And then an actual agency.
Yeah, important distinction.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So
do you want to know? You're asking me what I think about those ones that are tied at the hip.
Yes.
I think that's a pretty reasonable market solution to some of the rates that they're paying, and they take care of a lot of the. And I've worked for both of them. Full disclosure. They solve a lot of the things that the locums agencies provide, but at a much lower cost. So I don't personally view that as working with an agency, quote unquote. I view that as bypassing an agency, is the way I look at it. I guess that might be me trying to be consistent with my own opinion on using agencies, but that's what I have found.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm maybe a little different in that I've made the decision for myself not to work with national groups. So I don't actually interact with private equity backed organizations. I do that for philosophical reasons, but I've also have done it because I've actually found it to be a huge pain in my rear trying to interact with some of these groups. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to lie. There's a lot of administrative bloat. There's a lot of miscommunication, layers of administration. And this was actually from trying to get on staff at one hospital to provide locums coverage. And that experience actually kind of taught me that, yeah, I'm not doing that again. Now, you know, the problem with national groups is there's a lot of heterogeneity, right? So Shamit, I think, you know, where you are in Chicago, you know, you have a great group. And I think you guys have a culture, you know, it is what it is. But that's not the case for a lot of these practices that have been bought up. Mm-hmm. And I think from a locum standpoint, it can be pretty challenging to try to interface with some of these practices. So for me, I think when it comes down to the discussion of how do we secure contracts, I've learned for myself that it's always more sustainable, probably easier to interact directly with physicians. Okay. With physicians, with IR physicians specifically.
Okay.
So if I'm able to be connected with an IR in a certain hospital who has a need, he needs coverage, he or she, whoever, right? They need help. If I'm able to talk with them and they get to know me, I get to know them, then they can get me in touch with the right person to make it happen. And that's been probably the most sustainable, organic way of doing it.
Mm. What's your experience, Michelle?
Yeah, so that's great thoughts. And I wish that I could say that I have taken, well, I've moral high ground. I haven't signed an employment agreement with any of the national entities for many of the similar reasons, but I also do provide locum services for many of them, often through their kind of quasi agencies, mm-hmm. And a few times directly with the actual local group, although it's part of the national group. And I would agree with you. There are so many connections that I think most of the audience members are undervaluing. For example, here at SIR, every single person here is a potential contact. Any group looking for, and I said this on the last podcast, any group looking for a permanent doctor could very well be looking for a locums doctor. Mm-hmm. Maybe they've never had to even think about it because the market has changed so much, but maybe open to it and meeting them in person, for example, at SIR, huge difference. Just anecdotally, I can tell you, last week I went to a device company conference, mm-hmm. and been texting with a guy just about a potential job in Maryland. And I said, hey, maybe next week I'll be in your area. We should meet up. Mm-hmm. I look across the table as I walk. I texted it right as I walked into the meeting. I said at this table, look across, it's him. We met at the conference.
That's great.
And that relationship now is way more secure than it would have been just over the phone. And as it turns out, this device is something that I've used quite a bit. So I obviously walked away looking like someone that knows what the hell he's doing.
So the Bard power pick line. I got you.
Yeah. Gotcha. Exactly.
I got you.
I would agree with Shamit. You know, the middlemen and the bureaucracy that is ultimately part of some of these national entities, or even really any system for that matter, is necessary, and they will facilitate the steps. But the ultimate contact is the radiologist or the interventional mm-hmm. radiologist on site. Now, I will tell you, because I do probably a lot more hospital work than you do, some of the places that I've done services at are in tatters. They may not even have a radiologist. They're literally sourcing entire departments via locums agencies or locums doctors. So that presents a problem where you may be talking to someone that's not a radiologist. One particular site that I just spoke with, I was working directly with the CMO, not a radiologist.
So what was your point of contact there?
The CMO.
Your point, so you reach, are you cold calling? I mean, how are you?
No,
how are
I
you
called the
procuring?
Radiology department guy. I think a PA picked up and I was like, hey, I think you guys are looking for some locums work. And they said, yeah. And next thing I know, I'm getting a phone call from the chief medical officer. So some places are more destitute than others in terms of how high up the chain their service requirements are going. I was shocked to hear a CMO managing a radiology staffing situation, but that's just that's the situation that they were in.
I mean, at this point, with the amount of contracts that both of you have secured, you're both pretty much professional at this level.
Yeah.
I would say, this is not a side gig for either of you
no,
at this point.
That's correct.
You know, this is you are professional locums physicians. Walk me through your first few times procuring a contract, who your points of contact were, and who you seeked out. Were you seeking only radiologists? I know, Kavi, your initial experience was through an agency.
But that's
Michelle,
right.
I believe you were 100% independent from
no,
jump.
No, my first right? contract,
your
my
very
first and
okay.
only contract was through an agency.
Okay.
And then I moved very promptly from there to direct contact. So if you want, I can talk about my first direct contact was
yes.
actually was in the same state, Indiana, as my first agency contract. So I already held the state license.
Right.
I forget exactly how I connected with this group, but somebody somewhere posted something on some thread about a job in Indiana. I messaged that person, and then I quickly got in touch with the president of the group, and I secured, you know, months of work that way.
Oh.
And I have sort of perfected my techniques. I'm happy. I shouldn't say perfected. You know, there's still a lot to learn.
Yeah, still refining.
But
yeah.
My philosophy, and I'm curious, Kavi, what your opinion on this, but mm-hmm. I'm the contractor as opposed to a potential employee, so it behooves me to make the first offer. It's how I look at it. So I generally offer all of my clients a term sheet, and I sign it, and then I have them sign it back. And it's quasi-legally binding, but the idea is that like they take me seriously.
Do you have that worked out? Sorry to interrupt.
Mm-hmm.
You have that worked out, and have you had that run by a lawyer before you ever present it to your client?
No, I don't. It's a document that I created on my own,
okay.
and it goes over, I define some terms. Again, these are probably more important for me as a hospital person. You work in the hospital as well,
mm-hmm.
Kavi, but you know, how do we define a work day? How do we define call? How do we define a work week? And it depends on the client's needs, but I often incentivize them to keep me for a week or at least a full set of weekdays as opposed to just one individual day. But if they need that, I structure it that way in case they just need me for a Monday.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually not very rewarding for either party, but I want to make sure we have that defined. So work day, work week, call, I define these terms.
Yep.
And then go into the rates. Talk about cancellation, termination, which I think are two different, well, termination and rescheduling, I think are two different things. Termination is meaning we're going to end our relationship, and scheduling is, hey, we no longer need you, but we don't want to end the agreement, or you can't make it, but we don't want to end the agreement. So those are two different terms, the way that I approach it. I talk about travel costs, reimbursements, reimbursable expenses, licensing, and
malpractice.
And then I sign at the bottom, and I usually leave a line for them to sign. And that just, I think it lets them know that this ain't your first rodeo. And it gives them something that either they can take to an attorney to hammer out into a formal contract, or I think once I did it myself, but most of the time they have legal counsel that can hammer that with language that they're used to putting into their standard contracts.
Understood. And yeah. and you have only done hospital-based work.
That's correct. I haven't done
correct.
OBL work, which
okay.
I, for those who are just listening, I'm bowing towards Kavi because I think it's fascinating what he's doing from the OBL space. And I really do hope that we get to talking about, you know, what would it take for someone like me to come into your field? And I'm happy to talk about what it would take for someone to come into my, you know, type of interventional radiology. And of course, Kavi and I are separated by a number of years of experience. I'm, you know, less experienced than him, which I think plays a big deal.
Yeah. And so, my experience, I know I'm hosting this thing, but I'm much more similar to you. So my
yeah.
locums has all been secured by myself.
Right.
And then I do internal in my national group
right.
at other sites where they need help. So I have daily rates there.
Right.
But again, that's all through a W-2. So it's just on my regular W-2 full-time paycheck. It's just an added bonus. But my pure 1099 locums work, I met somebody on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
I met somebody who posted on the IR Docs group on Facebook
yeah.
who said, you know, we're in this town. We have this need. We can't hire, you know, a fourth guy. I have three amazing, you know, I have two amazing partners, and we just, you know, we just want a little more vacation to see our kids. It's been one of the most rewarding relationships I've ever had. Not even just in a financial sense, but really, you know, it's 150 miles away from where I live, so I am away from my wife and children. But the relationships that I developed with these three IRs is phenomenal. I've learned new techniques. I've seen how different models work. I have done this at two other sites as well, but this particular one is the benchmark by which I think all IRs can secure healthy relationships with companies if they are hospital-based. I'm with you in bowing to Kavi in being able
yeah.
to procure the OBL setup for locums coverage at a pretty early stage in your career. You know, you are not 10, 15 years out. You're within your first 5 years, right?
Maybe just as a reminder, I should say I'm 4 years out of training.
Four years
yeah,
out.
Five here. So Not that much more experience.
It seems like you have way more than I do.
Yeah. A lot more prostates for sure.
Yeah.
Seen a lot more prostates.
Felt like I lived a lot these last 5 years. So,
yeah.
You know, it's actually really funny because I think the process for me getting OBL contracts, no different than the process for all of us getting hospital contracts, comes down to the relationship with the practice owner. And I make the conscious decision to work specifically with physicians who own and operate their practices. And it just comes down to networking. I think I've been lucky in that my opportunities so far, it's not something that I had to seek out. They actually came to me.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it was really facilitated by activity, not only in SIR, but in OEIS. I got to meet a lot of people. I think
that's a great conference I've been to.
Yeah. Being vocal, the blog has connected me with a lot of people.
Mm.
I secured 2 locums contracts via the blog of all places.
Wow.
Yeah. So just kind of getting your name out there and just being active in the space certainly helps.
But I thought everybody thought you were a menace based on the blog.
I think they still do, but it turns out I'm actually a productive member of society.
So. All right, okay. So you can secure a job. I got you. Okay. If you have hope, then we all do. I see. Okay. So this is interesting. If you are procuring directly through the individual operators at these OBLs, what has your relationship been with OBL practices that are not 100% physician owned, where the business entity is not run through physicians?
Yes, I actually have one experience like that. This is actually my first experience, and maybe in some ways akin to using a recruiter to get your first hospital contract. And, you know, I'm going to preface this by saying that I have the utmost respect for that physician there. I think physicians who decide to use managerial services companies or, you know, give up equity, everybody's got their own reasons. So it's not here to judge, but to really talk about the process in terms of actually working locums.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I realized for myself is in order to actually work in this facility, I got connected via the managerial services organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I already had relationships with people in that organization. And I think on the whole, you know, the work that I got to do in this facility was great. I loved it. It was, you know, high-end peripheral arterial care, venous disease, things like that. No questions about the clinical care. But I think the biggest pain point for me was actually communication. There's layers of communication. Yeah. And I think for those of us who are so passionate about the OBL space, we gravitate towards OBLs because we do not want to deal with all the baggage that comes with large healthcare facilities,
yeah.
Right? That's like a huge thing for me. It just drives me bonkers. I just want to like run away from that as, you know, quick as I can. So When you find yourself in a situation in what should really be the promised land, but you end up having to go through similar hoops as you would in a hospital, it can be pretty off-putting. So that's not to say that it's not the right opportunity for the right person.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for me, I'd rather just deal directly with somebody who owns and operates their own facility.
Understood.
They'll tell me when they're taking vacation. They'll tell me when they need me. I know their practice patterns. I don't have to communicate through some third party or 2 different administrators. It just makes for a clean, healthier relationship.
Maybe too personal of a question. Do you charge doctors less than hospitals?
I actually do. And that's a decision that I make. I actually make less money in the OBL than I do working for healthcare systems.
Okay.
But I do charge physicians less. Now, that's not to say that you can't make more, but you want to prove yourself, right? So if you're able to help bring in business, and if you can be efficient and do cases and be productive, then you'll be rewarded handsomely.
I have to hesitatingly agree with Kavi. I approach my private groups very differently than I do hospitals, than I do national corporate entities. And some of that just comes back to my own personal opinion. And if you're not a private group, maybe an important thing to think about from what both of us are saying is that maybe the person that contacts you or deals with you directly as a physician. I think it just, I don't know, it softens my approach when I know it's somebody, it's one of my own, someone that we have shared training and shared background. It just changes my overall outlook. And yeah. I definitely find myself treating my private groups different than I do hospitals and private equity groups.
Yeah, I think there's no question about it. I think it is one of your own. And I think for me, I'll say about, you know, the OBL space, you know, it's not like I have like decades of experience doing like thousands of atherectomies or whatever. I've probably done more than most people in my level of, you know, career, if you will. But a lot of the people I work with, they're my mentors, right? They're people I look up to. They teach me a lot.
Mm.
Some of them have been guests on this podcast. So, you know, it's been excellent. So I kind of...
So you feel like charging less is both you paying it forward for them giving you some education as well?
Absolutely.
And I'm going to guess maybe sometimes you get something out of them as well. They may be available on site or maybe by call, and maybe if you're working at one of their facilities for an opinion. And I can tell you, as someone that works at places where I'm often the solo guy, man, not having a second person to just bounce an idea off of is a tremendous disservice sometimes to myself and some of my patients. So I think that's definitely a role to most of my private groups that I work with, just from a hospital perspective. I'm not alone. But the private equity and hospital base, I'm often alone on site. And so there's something to be said about that.
This makes a lot of sense. I think these are really important questions that touch on what people have been asking us, you know, informally through Twitter and Instagram and other media, you know, for the last few months since our last one came out. You know, one thing that you touched upon, Kavi, and one thing that, you know, Vishal, you definitely have opinions on as well, is when you go to a facility and, you know, I actually have a previous Backtable episode where I talked about building a skill set outside of what I did in training.
Fantastic episode, by the way.
It was not the number two episode of 2022.
Should have been number one.
But we hope to achieve those goals with this one. My question to you is, to you guys both, is how do you gain that comfort? How do you prove... So first of all, how do you gain that comfort? Is it pure, you know, going into the coal mine with a match? Or is it I am proving myself slowly to a group of physicians who will then vouch for me to administrative, or in the case of an OBL, just to the single or group of physicians that own the OBL? How does that relationship work where you secure the contract?
Yeah, I think, you know, a couple of things. I think OBL and hospital is a little different. I think, you know, Vishal, I haven't done nearly as many hospital contracts as you. I've only done a couple. But I think for the hospital, for me, you know, that contract tends to be a lot, at least in my experience, has been a lot easier. It's been a lot less proving of myself per se. I think really the proving of myself was just having a philosophical, you know, heart-to-heart conversation with the IR, you know, them understanding like, hey, I think this is a guy who I'd want to be partners with, right? And then that goes a long ways. And then actually showing up and doing good work is the other thing. I think for the OBL, it's a little different. I think you have to have a concrete skill set and be able to show that you can be safe and effective and profitable in that environment before you even get there. And I don't think that would have been possible for me had I not already helped build an OBL and done that. I think it's pretty hard. I'm not saying it's impossible. Nothing's impossible. But I think it'd be pretty hard to just, you know, show up and say, hey, I'm gonna do these four multi-level PAD cases and knock out these vein ablations and seeing these four consults. That's probably not going to happen. Or if it does happen, you're probably not doing a great job. So I think for me, at least in my career, it involved being in the hospital for a couple of years, actually cutting my teeth, spending 4 hours to do an atherectomy, spending 3 to 4 hours to do a PAE, then taking the skill set from there, going to the OBL, and then doing hundreds of them, cutting my teeth some more and getting faster and safer and efficient. And then finally getting the point where I can actually market myself to people and say, hey, I could actually do it.
Can I ask a question to him? Because I have a single page document that I sent on to all my clients, what I call a locums profile. It's got my photo, where I trained, and what I consider area of expertise. And then every site that I work at, I solicit reviews from everyone on site. Usually at least once a year. And I have a bar graph that shows, you know, how am I overall? How am I in communication? How am I in friendliness? How am I in actual clinical skill, et cetera, et cetera?
Phenomenal idea, by the way.
At the bottom, I have little, actually, I have people on the back of the form write down actual word comments. I actually tell them, please be negative. I don't put that in my document, but I find some of that to be the most helpful nonverbal feedback that I get, especially for some of the more experienced techs or nurses that maybe they're even experienced physicians, because they tend to give you very good feedback. Anyways, I put that together, and that's what I propose. And it says how many states I've done, how many procedures I've done, et cetera, et cetera. I give that to all my clients to let them know that I know what I'm doing and I've done this for a while. Do you do something like that with your OBLs? Like, do you have to, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to take over the questions. I was just curious.
That is a phenomenal, I think it's a great idea.
I think it's great. I think you've given me a good idea I should do.
I'm definitely updating my CV.
Selling some of these ideas.
It's like, great. Wow.
Well, I find that it's better than a CV, because CV contains a lot of information.
This is very locum specific.
It's very locum specific, and it's one page and it hits the high notes. So,
I love it.
Yeah, you know, I haven't.
Okay.
I haven't. I probably should. Yeah.
I think you just changed the playbook, honestly.
Yeah, that's very, very unique. I mean, that's actually really fantastic. I think mine's just been word of mouth.
Okay.
It's been, you know, one person's going to call another person and say, hey, is this guy a joker or not? Yeah. And, you know, usually the answer is no. And then it works out. But I like the way you've done it.
Yeah.
I think that's great.
Yeah. I mean, Kavi, we've had a couple of conversations online where you've connected through device reps.
I have.
Isn't that right?
That's right.
Can you speak a little bit about that?
So this is actually my hospital contract in South Dakota was via a device rep. You know, it was a device that I used in the hospital when I was in Minnesota. Had good support from them, did a fair number of cases with this device. And I didn't know about an opportunity that presented itself in South Dakota, but they, you know, one of the guys called me and said, hey, you know, one of my buddies who's an IR here in this hospital needs some help. Do you think you can do some work for them? And that was great, because that actually proved to be an introduction to that IR, who I probably wouldn't have met otherwise. Mm-hmm. And then I got to know them, and then we kind of hit it off. And, you know, next thing you know, I'm committed to be there for like 8 months. So pretty awesome.
One thing I've definitely learned, you know, being 5 years out from training, is that the people who know things the first in all of medicine are the device reps. I think this was on a previous episode with Aaron and Chaz Sanders. Yeah. But I mean, they know.
Yeah.
They know everything.
They're a great resource.
And they're just the best resource. And they really don't have any skin in the game as to who's covering what market. It's mostly just they'll try to hook the doctors up who they think do a good job with opportunities that they think will match. So
can I add
this
two
makes
thoughts
a lot
to
of
that?
Sense. Yeah, please do.
I have been in a similar position with a large mechanical thrombectomy company, we'll say. And I agree with you wholeheartedly, which is they have no skin in the game. They just want to help out a lot of the times. And actually, maybe I would maybe make the argument sometimes they do have skin in the game. So at one of the sites that I most recently worked at, and I think it's probably coming to an end, I launched their thrombectomy program.
Yes.
And so they know now that I'm an experienced user. And if they know of any sites that don't have anyone, or maybe one of their colleagues in a different state, it knows that there's a hospital in town that doesn't have an experienced user or any interest, and there's no one doing it, you know, they'll connect you up. And that's happened once or twice. Made some contacts that way. One of them may come to fruition here in Maryland, like I was talking to you about. Secondly, just to piggyback about reps, techs and nurses are also very valuable.
Absolutely.
Many of them are traveling.
Good point.
I have personally never got a contract from a tech or nurse who went somewhere else, but I have brought techs and nurses to sites because I've worked with them somewhere else.
Yeah.
One happened most recently in Florida, where I worked with this traveling nurse at one place, and she was just fed up with it, found out I was going somewhere else, and she says, hey, do they need someone there? I was like, yeah, they probably do. And next thing I know, 2 months later, she's there. So there's a whole network of not just doctors, but techs and nurses as well that can be reliable.
So episode 3 is going to be Vishal's tech staffing agency.
Yes. But you know, I think it's a great comment, Vishal. I want to kind of touch again on the device companies, because I do think that, you know, look, I'm probably one of the most cynical people out there. There's no question about it, right? I write what I write. I believe what I believe, which is fine. But, you know, I do think at the end of the day, you got to understand the games that we play as a physician, right? And that the ecosystem in which we live in, and there is a business argument to be made for, you know, staffing good, you know, hospitals and having quality physicians in those hospitals, right? And some device reps are going to be motivated. They're going to have accounts that were, you know, really, really profitable.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, physician leaves and they, you know, their numbers go down and they live and die by their quarterly statements, right? That's just the game that they have to play.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think a lot of them are well-intentioned, right? I think a lot of them, you know, truly, you have great relationships with them. There's no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one thing I learned is it's funny you mentioned mechanical thrombectomy. You know, I think it's like anything in life, you kind of have to follow the money. And once you realize what the incentives are for people, you know, you can actually use that to benefit all parties, right?
Yeah.
So you see that with mechanical thrombectomy when it comes to hospital contracts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an IR physician leaves in a certain facility, maybe they were a high user of a certain device, you can get connected that way. You see it in the OBL space. You see it with atherectomy, right? You see it with embolization. So I think that's all important. I think it behooves the listener to kind of understand what kind of the macro healthcare economic landscape is like and how it applies to these different settings.
I think what we're describing here is, I shouldn't say new, but certainly novel, I suppose, or adjustment to a new way of practicing interventional radiology. I don't think anybody thought about this type of IR locums work leading to some of the connections that we're talking about. Whereas typically that would be reserved for maybe a very productive private physician or an academic physician. So it's been very gratifying for me.
So I want to take that to two questions, because after my next question, I do want to talk about rates, specifically about rates, which I think, you know, listeners are really interested in because we are experienced people and we have negotiated our own contracts. So they want to know what we're charging, essentially, at least a floor. But the first thing I want to talk about is just talking about macro, you know, macro changes, like waves of change that are coming on the on these forces that are really changing the way that we practice and how hospitals view IR as well, right? So the society is also changing. We're here at SIR, you know, everyone is talking about the new training paradigm. We've now graduated our, what, two full classes all the way through of the integrated IR program. The training paradigm is changing. We live in a time where people are going more towards teleradiology in the diagnostic field, and IRs are still considered a commodity under radiology. So how does this affect locums? How does the new training, it's a very broad question, so take it however you will. How does the new training paradigm shift and the society's shift in a clinical IR, it's going to be a long shift, how does that affect locums? Staffing, filling spots, all of this.
So, you know, I can start from the OBL side. And I actually think when it comes to OBL locums, I think it makes it these opportunities harder to come by. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because I think we're actually starting to see more young IRs coming out who want to be in OBLs, right? They want to be in OBL ASC practices, whether that's physician-owned and operated, corporate, MSO, whatever, multidisciplinary, you name it.
Outpatient medicine.
Outpatient medicine. And, you know, I feel like that is where we're going to be headed, right? I'm not saying that's like the end-all, be-all answer to all of our problems. You still need a hospital to do good work. Certain types of patients have to be treated. But I think when it comes to OBL opportunities, I think, you know, we're going to be seeing more full-time employment in these settings. I think we're already starting to see it. So when it comes to staffing needs in the OBL, the biggest issue right now is, can you have an owner, operator, a primary physician in any one of these facilities who's willing to take on a novice partner to do this? That's the problem. It takes at least a few years to get up to speed on what's necessary to be safe and efficient in the OBL setting. And, you know, there's always going to be opportunities to kind of fill staffing needs from that perspective. But I think over time, it's probably going to dwindle. That's kind of my crystal ball, which is admittedly always a little cloudy. But I think when I think of OBL, I think about it from that perspective. I'd be curious, Michelle, what you think about the hospital.
Well, I just want to interrupt real quick. I mean, you, it's a good point, and you have your finger on the pulse. I mean, I doubt there are many people here at SIR who have as many contacts in both the inpatient and outpatient world as you do. I have a ton in the inpatient world, but I have very few in the OBL world. So I think your perspective is going to be very well taken.
And I want to touch base on the OBL stuff you're talking about, because I think I may have mentioned this in the first episode. That was my intention out of training, was to open one in Atlanta, and didn't end up working for a variety of reasons I described in the first podcast. But I think you could make the argument that the OBL ASC topic in interventional radiology is a recent one, and it's a developing topic that represents a change that the field wants to make. They want to move into the outpatient sphere, own their patients, et cetera, et cetera. And so, and then, of course, you're seeing private equity take over a lot of radiology. You're also seeing a lot of teleradiology. So I view locums, and it's, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but just anecdotally, I feel like there's a lot more interest in locums radiology, interventional or diagnostic combined, is just a representation of the shifting in the field and people trying to figure out what they want. Now, whether locums radiology or interventional radiology in this case is a permanent thing, would, I think, very much differ from the OBL space versus the ASC space. I mean, the inpatient hospital space. But like, I'm excited, for example, we're talking about new trainees. I'm excited for someone to say, call, maybe someone listening to this podcast right now, maybe someone who's a resident right now at a DRIR program saying, hey, Covey's going down to Florida to do a bunch of PAE. We don't do a whole lot of this here. Why don't you take me out there and let him, you know, you could be developing an academic, I'm giving you some ideas, maybe you've already thought of him. You could develop an academic affiliation. And this is, I think, one of the major pitfalls of our own field, and I'm not the first to say this, I know it. We talked about this last night.
We did.
I've talked to a lot of people ad nauseum. You know, certain, not all programs offer everything, but there are plenty of people out there who are doing high volume stuff. Why are we not sending?
And willing to teach.
Absolutely. I know some older people that are getting ready to retire who are going to take 3 decades worth of experience to the grave, and have they taught a soul? They haven't had the opportunity to.
So I was just speaking outside the convention center with Kavi, with a pretty prominent member in the early career section.
Yeah.
We were speaking about how there's this new initiative amongst the early career section to have trainees come out to OBLs and learn techniques.
Yeah.
I quickly mentioned that actually Kavi, yeah. A friend of ours, Ely Baelish, and I actually posited this on the IR Facebook group with about, you know, 200 to 300 radiologists are on that group.
Yeah.
We actually said, please anonymously leave your email if yeah. you are willing to host medical students,
yeah.
Residents
yeah.
who are not getting peripheral arterial disease
yeah.
exposure and,
yeah.
and you are doing it. Initially, when it was anonymous, we had tons of people saying, bump, follow me, you know, all this stuff. As soon as we actually linked the spreadsheet, I think we got maybe two people who listed their email. We had tons of people interested from the resident side,
yeah.
but we had very few people who wanted to see it through and be and do it from the teaching standpoint when they had to put their name down
really?
And commit to it. It's a small sample size and
yeah.
it's just off Facebook. It was not done through the society. So this is purely anecdotal
yeah.
and it was more of a thought experiment than it was a formal opportunity. But I think this idea is real.
Yeah.
And I think that there are plenty of people out there who are willing to offer
I can't
it.
Speak about the OBL space, but I can tell you that I've hosted a medical student for training, which is something that sort of landed in my plate and I found it extremely gratifying. And it made me actually go back to some primary literature before I taught any black pearls.
Yeah.
So that's shocking to hear and maybe saddening if true, maybe not true, which would be hopeful.
Yes,
I'm
hopeful that because it was on Facebook.
Yeah, exactly.
An IR group on
Facebook. I think it probably wasn't the right audience because I think, right. you know, it's still going to be mostly hospital-based to begin with. And I think maybe if we were to, you know, even an SIR, it's still predominantly hospital-based. I think if we were to raise a similar suggestion to something like OEIS, we'd probably get more people.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wonder, to take it a step further, I wonder what you guys would think if we were to raise this idea to multi-specialty collaboration for trainees to go out to vascular surgery ASCs, to interventional nephrology ASCs, to interventional cardiology OBLs, and to see if we could get some of that restitution for, you know, for decades of innovating and collaborating.
That's a bold
over
suggestion.
The last 40
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
you know, I mean,
as a society, I mean, the question is, as a society, is that something that we are willing to at least promote? Yeah. We don't have to pound on doors.
Yeah.
But is that something that we would be open to suggestion to?
So
and that's all I'm asking.
I'll give my thoughts on that. So you know, I'm married to a vascular surgeon. And I was actually a business partner with an interventional cardiologist. And I actually learned most of what I know about PAD, not from an interventional radiologist, but I was actually taught by an interventional cardiologist. And even though the relationship didn't work out, I mean, I still credit him. I mean, he gave me a lot of information, a lot of knowledge. And I think, look, I think the issue with multidisciplinary care in IR is this, okay? It's not the actual multidisciplinary aspect of it. I think it's that IRs need to elevate their game to be at the same level as the other specialties when it comes to comprehensive clinical care.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we can operate on the same level playing field, then I think there are opportunities for collaboration. And I think there's good people out there who'd be willing to do it, right? But I think if we're not going to accept that responsibility, and if we're just going to be there to just kind of crush some sweet multi-level PAD cases and that's it, then it's not going to be a great experience. My two cents.
Maybe we can, the original question I think was about training pathway and how, and
correct.
Locums and how they intersect. And Kavi obviously talked a lot about the OBL space.
Yes.
I know I spoke in episode one about coming out of training and going directly into locums interventional radiology, which I probably didn't realize was that crazy of a thing until Kavi was like, oh, wow, that's, and that was the first time that I realized, yeah, that was kind of crazy to do that. Maybe we can even talk about the kinds of phone calls that we have fielded.
Definitely.
I have fielded phone calls from people that are still in training, people that are out of training, just out of training. I fielded, I think, one phone call from someone that is out of training but wants to go back for some additional advanced interventional training. Even got a phone call from the attending in my residency program who taught me a lot of what I know, which was very humbling. And I have to credit the podcast for that. It just made me feel like I've done something unique here. So I think that you may see a lot of people coming out of training thinking about doing locums interventional radiology as they try to figure out where the market's going to go. It does come with some downsides. And you might talk more about the OBL space because I think that's a very different beast, especially because most interventional radiology training is still hospital-based, so it's not quite as big of a leap. But it is tough to come out and maybe use a product you've never used before, handle a condition you've never handled before, not have any backup, and be working in an environment where you haven't developed a reputation And I defend a lot of locums doctors who may just come and maybe they work just 1 week a year, 2 weeks a year, mm-hmm. maybe only have been to the site once or twice. It's a very different risk profile when you're doing a high risk procedure and no one knows your reputation. Mm-hmm. Very easy to ruin your reputation versus say you're coming to the site like where you're going or even some of my clients where I've been there steadily over many years.
Right.
I can afford to take some greater risks. So it's not easy, but the advantages are definitely there. Financial for sure. We're going to talk about that at some point, but also seeing a broad variety of cases, not everything, and I have to be upfront about that, but also learning how to develop new relationships. It would pay dividends if you end up taking a permanent job afterwards.
Yeah. No, I think that's all great stuff. I think we're running a little short on time, so yeah. I do want to get to what you just alluded to, yeah. Which is a bit about, you know, what are we seeing out there these days? You know, I don't want to give like full exact numbers of where exactly your term sheets are, where your contracts are. I don't think that's fair to us or to locums agencies or to hospitals, really. But the number one question I've gotten after this podcast, because people care about their future, is what makes this worth my time?
Yeah.
Essentially, what is the floor? So let's do two scenarios: high cost of living, metropolitan area and suburbs of that area, and then rural America. Okay, and then Kavi can add the third piece, which is
OBL,
which only if you are comfortable with, because I know you deal directly with physicians and the most of those.
Absolutely. Yep.
So Vishal, if you want to talk a bit about rural hospital practices, like groups plus hospital, a floor number would be helpful to our listeners.
Yeah, I'll come out and say it. I mean, I think $3,000 a day is a pretty reasonable floor.
Okay.
All
inclusive.
Yeah, meaning a 8 or 9 hour workday. I will tell you some clients have tried to convince me that it's an 8 hour workday with a 1 hour lunch break, and I tell them politely
alter that.
Yeah, that doesn't. We all know that doesn't happen.
Yes.
I never get a lunch hour break. Usually it's a 9 hour day. Yes. You can define that however you want to. Some groups have a swing shift or something like that, but you just define that however you want to. And I think that set core amount. $3,000 is pretty reasonable.
Callback rates, weekend coverage.
So this is, I think it depends on the volume and whether you want to do a day-by-day pager fee to hold the pager or just a flat rate mm-hmm. for whether you get called in or not. So you have to kind of make that decision based on the volume. And many of my clients who are new, and that's when I'm usually starting the contract and writing the term sheet, I don't know what their call is really like. And so I tend to work with a daily rate, a daily pager fee, and then a callback rate. And the great thing about doing that is I often bleed the callback rate, which is me coming in for an overnight emergency, with an overtime rate, and I just make them the same. So, I've seen the gamut for a weekday call, but I think $350 to $450 a night to hold the pager is a pretty respectable fee. And then just like our diagnostic colleagues, $400 an hour for anything you're doing outside of normal work hours is a pretty healthy rate. And I am a full-time guy, so I'm a full-time locum, so I'm more concerned about sustainability, and I tend to come back to my clients. And so for me, that I'm thinking about how can I make this to where it works for me and it works for them. Other people who maybe just work one week period, or maybe much more infrequently, for them, there's a high upfront cost and a lot of stress knowing that you'll never get the dividends of being there many, many times. So you may change the rate for that. And then my weekends are valuable. And I think that this is one place that many of us undersell ourselves. And I'm beginning to learn that maybe even I do myself. I think $1,200 a weekend day.
Per day.
Is
for 24-hour.
For 24-hour holding that pager. And I tend to work with most of my clients to cover diagnostic work as well. That's something that I'm even exploring myself because I'm realizing I'm working a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very different to just cover the pager. Versus re-diagnostic and be on site and then handle the IR emergencies as they come.
Yes.
Very different stress level on the following week in terms of how rested you are.
Mm-hmm. Kavi, anything to add?
Yeah, I think with the hospital, actually, Vishal, you tell me a lot from the last podcast. I think, you know, it really depends on the setting. I think if it's a diagnostic radiology group that contracts with the hospital that has IRs, that's different from if you're hospital employed. I've gravitated only to hospital employed models because I find that it's actually more lucrative.
Yeah.
For the locums IR, I think it's just better. From that standpoint, I think, you know, I agree with the floor. I think if you're going to travel anywhere to provide a service in this current market, you shouldn't accept anything less than that. I think the ceiling could be a lot higher.
Absolutely.
And to give, you know.
Are you paying your own way? Are you renting your own car?
I do. I pay my own expenses. I expense it. LLC. We got that. We talked about that last time.
And if I could just add on that, I've done both, where I have the client reimburse me for all expenses. I think the hospitals are fairly familiar with that, but the private groups sometimes just want a lump sum figure and you take care of that on your own.
Sure. So anyone who's not familiar with the structuring and what these guys are talking about, please listen to the first episode.
Lots of good pearls there. So I think, I think the ceiling could be a lot higher. I think just to put this out there for, listeners, based on my conversations with, founders of recruiting companies, staffers, these guys are charging somewhere on the order of $6,000-$7,000 a day, roughly, okay, with 30 to 40% profit margins. So you can just do the math and kind of see where that runs in. So there's an opportunity to have a ceiling that's significantly higher than the floor that we mentioned. It has to be the right setting. I think the OBL is a different game. I think for the OBL, it really depends on the types of cases you're doing, the types of setting you're in, and your geography and your payer mix. So to just put some hard numbers out there, I think for anybody interested in dialysis interventions, you're typically talking about larger corporate-like entities. You are going to have a hard time supporting a rate of greater than $3,000 a day. It's probably going to somewhere fall between 2 and 3. If you're working for vein clinics, it's probably going to be somewhere between the high 2s to the low 3s. If you're talking about embolizations or peripheral arterial disease, you're going to be talking a lot higher. Generally, you're going to want to come in at a floor of somewhere between, $2,500 and $3,500 a day. I usually make it $3,000. Then you can have, revenue that you generate above it, a percent of revenue. Typically, that figure should probably fall somewhere between 10 to 20%. So it just kind of depends on how busy you are.
This is,
people want to know.
This is really important
stuff.
And I'm
glad that we're talking about
it. I thank you guys for being so transparent. I will say that I fall within all of these, and my contracts. I think that they're very fair. And from what I'm hearing from people who have reached out to me, this is exactly the content they want to hear. So
I try not to get in the business of undercutting colleagues, particularly, for example, if I'm working at a private group, for example, that needs interventional radiology locums person. It doesn't make any sense for me to work for less than their own existing interventional radiologist, because ultimately I'm demeaning their value. It'll come back and bite them. So
I actually had an interesting story where I was sharing dinner with a friend of ours. I was out in a certain market having dinner. Great guy. He told me about this wonderful opportunity that he just got a locums assignment for. It actually just happened to be the same opportunity that I was looking at. And I was told that they no longer needed my services. And then I was like, oh, that sounds kind of familiar. And he's like, I'm doing it for, 80% of what I asked for. I was like, oh, there you go. And I don't think it's any, like you said, Vishal, I don't think it's any IR trying to intentionally undercut. Yeah. No one's trying to intentionally undercut anyone, but I just don't think this information is transparent, right?
Okay.
We have to be transparent about it.
Absolutely.
So, anecdotally, I believe the transparency helps because I have personal example of a friend who was looking to join as a locums in a private demics group where the senior partners were not being transparent and kicking everything up to admin.
Yeah.
And both not only offering jobs as a 1099 independent contractor, which is truly what this person would have been as a, just very part-time locums like myself, week at a time, but also not really willing to negotiate rates and meet even halfway in the middle. I think having a transparent discussion really helps. People like this, like my friend who truly don't know what the market is out there, he calls me or he calls Kavi and this sort of thing is going to help a lot of IRs.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so if I can just add an anecdotal story related to that, it creates a lot of resentment as well.
Yes.
I recently worked at a place where the director was recruiting a full-time interventional radiologist, and he himself had been serving that role and was not really responsible for the comp package. And as he's done interviewing and keeping in touch with the client, he finds out what the package is and finds out the guy that he interviewed, who's supposed to be a subordinate in terms of the hierarchy, was getting a much better offer than he was. And this kind of price intransparency or opaqueness happens, particularly in corporate radiology, and it behooves you to keep your ear to the ground.
Guys, we've talked about a whole range of topics. I think we've answered every question that I've got on Twitter and Instagram. If you guys have any, promotional stuff for your websites, your Twitters, your this or your that, social media, please, any final thoughts also, please just let the listeners know. Now's your time.
Yeah, sure. So thank thanks to all you guys. This is great. Appreciate the opportunity to do it again. Hope it's valuable for people. I think one thing I learned, Vishal, you definitely kind of changed things for me in a very positive way after that last episode we did. Learned a lot. I encourage people to take the time, network. Okay, whether or not you use a recruiter or not, just network, get to know people. You know, I've had a great time here at SIR speaking. I'll be at OEIS and I'll be at SEAS in Florida this year. People could contact me. Easiest way is probably on Twitter. Check out my blog, linemonkeymd.com.
Shumath, thanks for putting this together. You called me just, I don't know, an hour and 30 minutes ago. We're all here at SIR.
So glad you're here, man. Hey, this is awesome.
Do you want to do an impromptu episode 2? And I was like, yeah. And maybe we'll do an impromptu episode 3 at some point. Yeah, and that'll be number 1, number Absolutely. 2, and number 3 in the most popular podcasts. In terms of final comments, major things that I've seen change, the one thing that I started the podcast at the beginning is this exclusive agreement that I ran into. I don't know if that's going to become a new trend and something for anyone thinking about going into the space to be cognizant of. It seems like an appropriate response from the agencies. And maybe those people who are listening who are maybe on the other side of this looking to staff their, you know, groups, be wary of that and maybe deepen your pool of physician context so you don't find yourself shackled by this. And then the market is changing. It has changed since the last time we spoke. So keep your ear to the ground. We didn't really talk about this, maybe a topic for another episode, but you know, what are we seeing in rural versus non-rural America, as well as, you know, where do we think the locums market is going to go with all the changes? But my contact information has always been the same. They can always reach out to you or call me directly and through you or whatever. I'm happy to answer any questions, particularly off the record. So
phenomenal. Yeah. Thank you guys. Yeah, this was phenomenal. Hoping to catch a drink with you guys later today. This is really, really fun. I hope we get to do episode 3 at some point. Just I want to thank Backtable again. It's been really fun being a guest host on the podcast. And live from SIR. It's been a great time. So thanks everybody. I hope you enjoy the episode.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us @_backtable on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable is produced and hosted by myself, Aaron Fritz, and co-hosts
Chris Beck, Sabine Dawn,
Michael Barraza,
and Ali Behetti.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhorter,
Aaron Bowles, Nick Shellcross,
and Ness Smith-Savadoff.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Article and transcript support by Taylor Robinson
and Delaney Aguilar.
Social media and PR by Anne Dang.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kinnebrew.
Intro and extra music is Ripperoo by Skeptic Mood. Find us on Spotify or at local live music venues in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thanks again for listening.